Welcome to Season 4 of White Shores, the podcast for spiritual beings having a human experience. Let me invite you to walk once more beside me on White Shores to talk about the real meaning of life. Let's discuss dreams, rituals, intuition, afterlife, angels, and other infinite possibilities within and all around you. Season 1 featured interviews with some of the world's leading scientists researching consciousness, and Season 2 and 3 built on that solid foundation by talking to authentic spiritual experts, authors, and practitioners. And the bold theme of this season is truth, whatever that means. I hope every episode offers you much needed inspiration, meaning and comfort, and perhaps even a little joy in these challenging times. So, now the scene is set, allow the grey rain curtain of this world to roll back and all to turn to silver glass. Let's walk barefoot together on the gentle, glistening sands of White Shores to see what magic lies beyond the material. Thank you for arriving safely on White Shores, a far green country under a swift sunrise. My guest today is a noted parapsychologist. About 10 years ago, I first connected with him as he was researching paranormal true life stories for his thesis, and he had a particular interest in stories concerning technology. And of course, many of my books contain true life, afterlife experiences. We've kept in touch ever since to compare notes. I've closely followed his brilliant research into the reality and psychology of paranormal or supernormal experiences. It's actually his second visit on White Shores. You can listen to his first compelling and much downloaded interview in Season 1. It's not just a compelling interview, but an important one for this podcast, because he brought with it a healthy dose of skepticism. You get to hear the other side. That's why I'm thrilled he agreed to talk to us again today. In my latest title, The Truth About Angels, you'll see that increasingly I'm championing a more sceptical approach, encouraging you all to constantly ask questions of yourself and of others, in particular those who tell you that they have seen or know the truth about the afterlife or spirituality. Perhaps they are wise and perhaps they have seen a great deal or experienced a great deal, but even if they have, that's their truth. I truly believe the journey of your life is to find your truth. Such is my admiration of my guest and his deeply respectful approach to both believers and skeptics in his research, that any chance I get, you'll find me quoting his studies and his books in my afterlife writing. I'm particularly drawn to his bereavement dreams research, which has shown that in over 85% of cases, dreaming of a departed loved one can be a positive and healing experience, whether you believe that to be an afterlife sign or communication or not. Such dreams help you maintain a spiritual connection with a departed loved one. And in my opinion, understanding that death isn't the end and loved ones can live on through our dreams, our memories, and every time we think about them is an important, perhaps the final stage of grief, the stage when you can find deeper meaning through your loss. And while on the subject of dreams and the spiritual strength they can bring, I'm excited to announce that I'm going to be doing an online talk and workshop, a live one, about angels and dreams on May the 24th, 6 to 7:30 p.m. UK time for Olympia's 2021 Mind Body Spirit Wellbeing Festival. I feel truly honoured, as the festival is a much-loved staple of the Mind Body Spirit year, and I've been asked to launch it this year with the first talk. Tickets cost £16, and for every ticket sold, a tree will be planted. I do hope we can plant a forest with my event, and I hope to see you there because it's going to be a really illuminating experience. Details can be found at www.mindbodyspirit.co.uk. And when you get there, if you want a book, you need to visit the Wellbeing Festival section and find my Angels and Dreams event. And if you are listening to this podcast and it's after May 2021, of course, the event will be over. But the festival will return, as it has done since the early 1970s, the following year in 2022, and every year after that. Back to my fascinating guest today. I think you're going to love this interview, and I hope it inspires in you deep curiosity to find out more about my guest. I actually think he's a rising star, and if you follow him, you'll see the likes of the BBC agree, as he's doing lots and lots of media about his parapsychological research. He also lectures and has great talks on YouTube, etc., that you can check out. But it's not just curiosity about him that I hope this interview will inspire. It's about the subject he champions, parapsychology. It's an utterly absorbing area of study. And once you start investigating it, finding out about it, you'll never want to stop. Curiosity, asking questions, learning, growth is the theme of this interview. And it's also the theme of the famous classical music gift I hope you will listen to after the interview. I always picture a person standing in front of a mountain when I listen to it and wondering what the bigger picture of their life is. Do let me know what this piece inspires to you when you listen to it. It's a very famous piece of music. You may well be familiar with it already. It's played by my son and Royal College of Music scholar Robert. And Robert is kindly producing White Shores podcast. And on that visionary note, it's high time now to meet my guest. He's absolutely brilliant. He's a real truth seeker. Stay tuned. If you would like to find out more about my books, warning, I'm a serial spiritual writer, as well as my features, media, mission, and talks, please do visit www.teresachung.com and subscribe to my newsletter for updates, as well as free gifts and incredible stories to your inbox. If you have any questions, insights, or stories to share, please email me at my trusty angeltalk710@aol.com email, or message me via my author pages on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. I aim to reply to everyone in due course. Season 1 of White Shores can be found on the podcast page of my website, and all seasons can be found wherever you download your podcasts. Be honoured and grateful if you could leave a review, as it helps spread the word that spirit is real. Walking beside me once more on this episode of White Shores is parapsychologist, science promoter, noted skeptic, and senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Northampton, Callum E. Cooper. Now, Callum appeared in a very popular episode of season 1 of White Shores. I'm just thrilled he's back. Season 1, you may recall, laid the foundations of this entire podcast as I spoke to some of the world's leading scientists researching consciousness. Callum and I have known each other for a few good years now. We first got in touch because of the afterlife stories in my books, and he was writing a book about paranormal phone calls and technology, and that was his area of research at the time. He's also researched dreams of the bereaved, and many of my books feature the healing power of those night visions. But aside from his brilliant pioneering research and books such as Telephone Calls from the Dead, not to mention his frequent media appearances shining a spotlight on paranormal phenomena, one of the major reasons I'm so thrilled he is back is because he brings a healthy dose of skepticism onto White Shores. Indeed, he's been shortlisted for the prestigious Occam's Razor Skeptic Award. I truly believe it's essential for both believers and skeptics to debate, to talk to each other, hear differing points of view. And I'm aware White Shores may have tilted a little too heavily towards belief in previous seasons. So thank you, Cal, for being here to balance the scales. Hello.
You're most welcome. And here I am. Hello. How are you doing?
Thank you. Much needed balance you're providing. So first of all, how are you coping now that you sort of the lockdown lifting with university life? Is that getting easier? Are you doing more in person or is it all still online?
Yeah, it's starting to get more in person, especially open days. So new students and their families coming to visit and have a look around. We're starting to move towards those again so people can have a good tour of the building and the facilities. Teaching face to face, that might be looking ahead to September, something like that. And I think as with every university, besides those that are already set up for distance learning, we've had our gremlins and ghosts in the system and things like that. And that's gone hand in hand with students and staff having, you know, their own, you know, families to juggle with, not just homework at home, but homeschooling while trying to do their own jobs. And I think many people have suffered cabin fever and many other things like that. I know I have. It's really not been easy. Everyone's got their own story to tell about lockdown, from just the daily struggles, their mental kind of wrestling with themselves, and also loss and things like that, personal loss, and being able to see family and things like that, especially when it comes to looking after loved ones' health and things like that.
Absolutely. But did you find that there was more interest in the kind of research and studies you do? Because if you're listening, Callum actually teaches parapsychology, you know, research into paranormal experiences as a human experiences at the Northampton, don't you? It's the most interesting degree in the world, in my opinion. But was there more interest in that, certainly in dreaming and the paranormal, supernormal experiences during lockdown when we all became more contemplative? Did you notice that?
Yeah, so to clarify that previous point, we certainly are one of the main universities to offer a module within the psychology curriculum where you can look at parapsychology, and then we get a fair bit of interest for people to come and do research degrees. So nothing taught, you come in with your question, and then you spend several years doing research on it and produce a thesis, so things like a PhD in parapsychology. I certainly saw a lot of articles online about people questioning whether there'd been a rise in poltergeist activity or people having these after-death communication experiences that they reported, from dreaming of the dead to sensing their presence and maybe even seeing apparitions and other things, smells and symbolic phenomena. One of the arguments could be that we're kind of pushed back into a time of similar to 100 years ago or so, when, especially in the winter months, we were spending more time at home. And last year, we were certainly forced into doing so by law in many ways. And, you know, nights are drawing in, it's very little daylight, people are inside, they're using artificial lighting, and they're spending more time in the home, and they might start to recognise things they hadn't before, odd sounds that the building makes, expansion and contraction of the woodwork and the central heating system, and certain reflections that are cast by certain shadows from the artificial lighting and the windows, many, many things. And I think many of those explanations, conventional explanations, might apply for why people many years ago had various corner of the eye phenomena that might have been misremembered, and it became more fantastical as their memory went along with retelling it. You know, I saw something out the corner of my eye. I saw a man standing in the corner of the room. I turned and looked at him, you know, getting more and more exaggerated potentially, or misremembered. But certainly I think people were taking more notice of it. There's been no official study of this. I've certainly got one potential student that wants to come in and make that the topic of his thesis. He's already someone that's very interested in apparitions and has done a lot of research on it. But he wants to try and focus on within this period of COVID-19 and lockdown restrictions, and reflect on people's experiences, go back and interview people throughout this time. So with that, we might be able to get some sort of measure or acknowledgement of whether people thought there was a rise, or whether the quality of these experiences were somehow better than just something that might be conventional.
But I love the way you described it, actually. It sounded like the perfect recipe for a good old-fashioned ghost story. We're all in our homes, you know.
And that's how it starts.
You know, and Yeah, like Campfire, you know, Henry James and all that, Turn of the Screw. It was just sounded delicious the way you're describing it. But for those who haven't listened to your previous interview way back in 2019, when I first launched White Shores or are new to your work, first of all, I urge you to go and listen to that interview because it's really compelling. But can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do?
Yeah, so I'm a psychologist first and foremost. I'm chartered with the British Psychological Society. And I'm a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of Northampton and a researcher there, hopefully about to become associate professor if all things go well. So stepping up from the title of doctor in some ways to go on to the next level. And I module coordinate, so I mainly run and watch over the third year module in parapsychology. So that's one of the options that psychology students can take in their third year as part of their degree. I supervise several PhD students that are mainly focused on parapsychology topics. And I also teach various classes on things such as death, dying and bereavement, positive psychology, human sexual behaviour, research methods. And I also have an interest in cyber psychology as well. So human-computer interaction and especially internet interaction. Even going back to this, what we're talking about, people having unusual experiences, how these are debated online. And especially the attitude from dogmatic skeptics, from biased editing on Wikipedia through to many other things as well, and the psychology behind some of these people. Because I'm a skeptic, but these are people that go one step beyond, like religious extremists. John Cleese talks about the fundamentalists as well, saying it's amazing when you talk to these people because of how right they believe they are without looking at the evidence. Or it's scary when you're confronted with these people that they don't know that they don't know what they're talking about. he steps up, you know, it's weird, you've got these people that don't know what they're talking about, and even worse, they don't even know that they don't know what they're talking about.
Sounds familiar. So, but it sounds riveting, it really does. It's so interesting. I mean, you're to have your days filled with that kind of research. And I'm going to say Professor Cooper from now on, because I'm a precog. I'm a precog, remember.
Oh, you're okay. Thanks for the promotion.
Okay, Sir Callum. Professor Cooper. Prime Minister next. Anyway,
oh, no, thank you.
You mentioned some, last time we spoke, you mentioned you were doing some interesting podcasts and media. Can you share that or give a heads up about it so people can check it out?
Yeah. Hello, Raven. You're with me already.
That's not a bird, by
not
the way.
Not a bird.
That's not the Edgar Allan Poe.
Certainly poem. Set on my arm, though. I'm working with Helen Blaby, who's a presenter for BBC Radio Northampton. We co-host a show called Science Detectives. Absolutely.
Raven is a little baby, by the way. A little baby girl. It's,
yeah, two and a half.
Like a bird.
I know you're doing a tweet. Do you want that? Do you want to take that
okay,
with me?
Shall we just scrap this and talk to Raven? Hello, Raven.
Do you not want to go?
Yes.
When she comes in the office, she wants to just take everything, pens and pencils. There you go.
She's an angel baby.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? It's a pen. So we've gone to everyone about all kinds of things. Dietitian, it's not. Go on, you run with that. Take it.
No.
I'm stuck with her when she comes in.
It reminds me of that. Do you remember that the TV went viral, didn't it? This guy was doing a news report. I think it was an American TV or Australian. I can't remember.
Oh yeah.
And his kids came in. And the wife
dived in and dragged them out. He lost his composure, though, totally over that. And it's when people were just starting to get familiar with that in lockdown circumstances that
war
happened.
Well done for saying calm and cool and collected.
Yeah, you have to. So we've had dietitians on. We had...
Sorry to go back because I've completely forgot. Science Detectives.
Science Detectives, BBC Radio Northampton, and it's on BBC Sounds for anyone that wants to catch up on it. And you can go back to all the episodes. I think we're just about coming to episode 8 now. And dietitians, we had a female captain for EasyJet telling us about how do planes fly. We've had sports.
What's your role in it? I'm trying to understand. What do you bring to it? Are you talking about?
Helen calls herself the innocent fool as the just general presenter who wants to know. I'm in as someone who's regularly gone on that radio station, BBC Radio Northampton, as a parapsychologist, But she said, it'd be great to just have you as a co-presenter generally as a scientist to actually approach all these other sciences. So I'm there as a co-presenter, but trying to kind of give my knowledge and spin of what I know of various aspects of science without crossing lines, because ultimately these people that we're interviewing are the experts. But the listeners want to know. So we get the listeners to email in and say, you know, what do you want to know about X? You know, how does this work? How does that work? You know, why do we have earwax? Or, you know, why do... Oh, I don't know. Why does helium make balloons float in the air? Why is it so light as a gas and things like that? Just going into all that, why do we taste? Why does that happen? How does food get from the taste buds to our brain and what's going on there? So we've been through all kinds of different topics, really. We're going to keep moving forward. We've had so many people to interview. One that I'm just interviewing on my own soon is a coroner who she's written a book recently called I've Seen Dead People. And interesting overlap to my work, because I've been interested recently in re-looking at the experiences of coroners in terms of anomalous experiences. You know, again, sense of presence phenomena. These people are detached from bereavement because they're not dealing with a personal loss. They're dealing with a profession. And to not be too crude about it, essentially a production line, very respectful, absolutely. But they have to be in a certain mindset, as a physician would be going around a hospital dealing with, you know, patients just about to go in remission or come out through to dying patients. And so why is it that people in the funeral industry would have experiences? So we're even going to, not on particularly that, but just generally about the funeral industry, to get people to be more aware of it and hopefully dispel some myths people might have about, you know, working with the dead and autopsies and preparation of bodies and things like that. I'm very keen to, you know, go down that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross route and try and make people more comfortable with the topic of death rather than hide away from it or feel like it's something to fear.
Thank you for that. I know I certainly get stories from coroners and funeral directors. A lot of them about butterflies, actually.
Oh.
Cluster of stories of noticing butterflies very active around the coffin, and the bereaved often see that as a sign. Now, there could be a perfectly logical scientific explanation for that. But for the departed loved one, well, not for the bereaved, it means something special, because, you know, butterflies have this powerful symbolism, don't they? You know, metamorphosis from a caterpillar to a butterfly. It's like the dying process in a way. So I don't know if you'd had stories about butterflies. I wonder if that, you know.
Yeah, certainly for the bereaved. I mean, there's been many of those, even through to robins landing in the garden soon after a loss and then associating it with that person. One that stands out particularly after a loss was two people went for a coffee and one saw a yellow butterfly land on their hand. But it was completely symbolic, because they said, oh, God, can you see that? It's beautiful. And the other friend couldn't see anything. So it was very much in their mind. It wasn't even a real butterfly that was there to create symbolism towards. It was certainly an internal creation that was being projected out, very much like how the founders of parapsychology, so psychical research, thought apparitions to be. They thought they weren't really out there in the real world. They'd come from your mind, but you were projecting them out there. So if more than one person saw them, somehow you're telepathically passing it on to the group. So you've got a collective group of witnesses. So I've heard about the butterflies, I've heard about the feathers, but they seem to be more of a physical thing. It's an actual feather you can pick up and save, or coins dropping, pennies, things like that. So, they're very common for people to draw associations, or sometimes these very strange sudden occurrence of things. Thank you very much. That's a lovely drawing.
You mentioned mind there, because there's all this research now about whether the mind can exist separate from the brain, and that's where, you know, our essence is and all that. You know, that's, you know, a whole field of research, isn't it, which near-death experiences perhaps suggest might be possible, that the mind can separate from the brain and body.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying. I mean, there's been loads of research into that. I mean, there's some very classic cases of near-death experiences where the people...
Daddy!
Yes?
No, it's a tea.
It's a ghost.
You see, Raven wants you to get it. Raven wants you to understand. She's saying, that's a good point, Teresa. Thank you, Raven.
It's a ghost on the shelf. Do you want the ghost? You can take it. It's a little beanie baby ghost. You can have it. Hang on. There we go. Do you want this? There you go.
Oh, not long, Raven. I just need your daddy for another 10, 15 minutes.
Are you able to snip this up into bits?
No.
I was just... This is going to be the weirdest one out of the lot.
Oh, it's going to be beautiful. It's real life. And I think that's what, you know, everyone can hear all these slick interviews. You can go to other podcasts for that. Near-death experiences, you know, the mind existing separate from brain and body. You know, that's kind of what it suggested, isn't it? You know, and there's all that research into transcendent experiences and the reality.
I mean, there's two fantastic books that came out about 5 years ago now, both by the same publisher. And one was an extension of a previous one called The Irreducible Mind. And its second part is called Beyond Physicalism, talking about mind-body separation. And the other one is called The Myth of the Afterlife, where essentially a lot of more materialist scientists have got together to, I suppose, talk about, well, mind and brain are one, really. There is no separation. And once you're dead, that's it, really. And, you know, neuroscience can offer evidence for this. But that doesn't mean to say that the book Beyond Physicalism is devoid of that. In fact, a lot of neuroscience research as well is also supporting some of these kind of outcomes that we have for psi phenomena as well, like ideas such as near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, whereby those people might claim that they've interacted with the deceased or come back with specific information that they shouldn't know about. So some classic near-death experience cases have involved people coming back and knowing which nurse specifically has taken their false teeth away, or knowing what's on the hospital roof, or certain conversations that are very specific that physicians and nurses have had. And so, you know, some of these lend support to the idea, and that's what they do at best. Because we haven't got any kind of really good evidence that is, you know, what exactly are we measuring? We don't really know what consciousness is to actually be able to say, well, this is a measurement of it outside of the body. It's very much the experiential data that comes back that tells us that something else potentially might be going on. Because how has the mind actually obtained information about something that seemingly should be unknown to that experience? They did some experiments that I like with Dr. Alex Tanis in the 1970s through the 80s. He claimed he could go out of body at will, so they tried to get him to look at targets several rooms away, where he was in a Ganzfeld meditation type chamber, and then he'd go four rooms away into a room with an optical illusion device that had three different targets that he had to predict: a quadrant, a color, and a symbol. And they'd also put strain gauges in the room to measure any physical deformations within the room. He got a heart monitor on, EEG, looking at his brainwave activity. And some really interesting outcomes where he was having periods of significant, you know, feedback on the targets and strain gauge activity, which again was lending support to his claim in some way, because there was no other conventional explanation really explored for why they were getting that with just him. Anyone else that tried it, they got nowhere near those kinds of results. So, and that's just one case. We have all sorts. We have apparitions, we have reincarnation cases and things like that. Minefield of conventional explanations, which is what we call anomalistic psychology, having an experience that seems paranormal and actually we've got the explanation somewhere already. Parapsychology tips its hat to that and is fully aware and fully engages with anomalistic psychology, but likes to sift the wheat from the chaff a bit more and say, but what about this case? This one doesn't seem to fit the bill. So we'll put that over there in the box with a question mark on it, and we'll come back to that in a bit and we'll look at it in more detail. So that's what we do.
We're talking of looking at, you know, afterlife experiences in more detail. I know that your book, Telephone Calls from the Dead, is hugely popular. So what drew your interest to that? And I think I recently connected you with a lady who did a really interesting episode on this podcast about her WhatsApps, which she believes are from heaven. And she's actually going to write a book about that now. She's gone ahead and got a publishing deal for it, her experience. Would you like to talk about that? First of all, about the book, because it is a must read if you're interested in that kind of afterlife experience.
Yes, it is a must read when it becomes available again. I've been so lazy on that, in that it sold out a long while ago and got around to making a Kindle or an ebook or anything really. And it needs preserving in that way, and it needs updating as well when I get the time to do. I should do. I need to pay it a lot more respect because it's my first proper book and it's still the most popular of the ones that I've done.
You have been kind of busy raising a family, so you're forgiven.
But essentially, I'm a big fan of the work of D. Scott Rogo. He was a parapsychologist that was murdered in his home at the age of 40 in 1990. And he'd made his own career in parapsychology. His background was a degree in music. And besides that, he just read and read and done independent research and just became a known authority figure for parapsychology. He'd done numerous books. He'd written about 30 in his lifetime, edited various things, consultant editor for Fate magazine. He'd written in many journals and articles and book chapters. But one book that he did with Raymond Bayliss, who was sort of his mentor, was called Phone Calls from the Dead. And they looked at 50 cases of people making the claim that they'd had unusual telephone experiences, where the majority seemed to be claims of speaking to the dead on the telephone. And that was 1979. So by 2008, 2009, I'd seen media reports of people making these claims of such telephone calls. And I wanted to follow them up because we had all sorts. We had better radio contact, emails, text messages, baby monitors, you name it. Technology was shifting. So do people still make this claim, especially for landline telephone conversations that were as extended as the one in that book? And from there, I was speaking to John Randall. He passed away in 2011, but he'd read a few of your books, Teresa, and had noted one case.
Is he okay?
I'd love to get a call from John. We used to speak on the telephone regularly. And he said, you know, here's a book. Here's the contact details. Maybe you should get in touch with us. So I think that was a stroke of luck that, you know,
about 10 years now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and that was about a year or so before John passed away. So that was very lucky that he was reading so much by that point on survival based topics. So that was what made him pick up your work. And so that's what connected you and I. The book came out in 2012, January. Yeah. It was finished mid 2011.
I love it.
And I hope it went out everywhere.
I love it. I hope it becomes available again and you get that sorted. What did you make of Louise and her WhatsApps? I mean, I don't know if you've researched it in depth. I mean,
It was mainly, I wrote a blurb for her and I'm going to walk with the laptop at the same time. So I'm just checking up on what little hands are doing. Where are you? Oh, no, that's the tumble dryer. Let's leave that alone. There we go. the main comment that I made
I was... love this episode. I love this episode. It's just beautiful.
The main comment was you know, that these were very personal to her, and I'd seen other instances of people having any kind of electrical disturbance associated with their post-death encounters. So even responsive flashing reading lights and you got a tomato, lovely. Responsive flashing reading lights, mobile phones going a bit haywire, problems with the TV, or thinking they've heard a voice interject on the radio. And so that was mainly my comment really for her, in the fact that this is a very kind of heartwarming personal insight into how anomalous experiences, be they electrical or some sort of apparition that someone might report, through to sense of presence phenomena, they have great healing quality and establish continued bonds for people with the dead, so that they have such a benefit to bereavement and moving forward. Sorry, I was just sorting out the time.
Well, I found her very convincing, and you know, it's her background in law as well. I find it particularly interesting when someone from a very rational, logical background has these experiences, and they're so utterly transformative. And for me, that's the healing. And good on her for going on and getting a book deal. If you want to listen to her episode, it's in previous season. I think I called it The Heart of a Law Lecturer. If you want to hear it, she tells her story. But I'm sure we'll hear more of her. But also, I really, really love and admire your research on dreams of the bereaved. In fact, I quote you in almost all my books, Cal. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Oh, bless you.
You appear. You appear in your research. I mean, you know, I'm authentic to who you are. You're a skeptic and you're a parapsych. You research paranormal experiences. But you've done this wonderful research into the potential healing quality of dreaming of departed loved ones. Mm-hmm. What would you say about that now, looking back at that research? Where are you at with it now?
Yeah, more people are starting to get involved. I don't mean on a major scale. I just mean a couple of colleagues, like Dr. Anna Katrine Puhl. She started to look at this, especially lucid dreaming as well. So when people are very much aware that they are dreaming and can take control of their dreams and are interacting with the dead. I suppose this was yes. Anna Katrine Pure, she started looking at it. A few papers have come out in the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research. And this was all kind of instigated really by not only the fact that I've been looking at this for my PhD when I was doing it, but a colleague of mine, Dr. David Saunders, his specialism is lucid dreaming, and he's part of our parapsychology module as well. So we'd done a few presentations to the Society for Psychical Research and the College of Psychic Studies on dreams of the dead. And there's some really interesting quality in some of them. I mean, a really famous case is called the Chaffin Will case, where five brothers had lost their father and owned a lot of land and wealthy man. And in his will, he'd left the entire estate and most of the money to his second youngest son, who was ill. So he wanted him to kind of, you know, enjoy some of the wealth or something while he was still alive. But he ended up living longer than expected. It was about 2 or 3 years later that one of the other brothers had a distinct dream that their father had come to him and said, "There is a second will, which I wrote before I died, which distributes everything to all of you equally. And it's in my daddy's old bomber jacket." So the grandfather of these five men. And so he woke and contacted his mother and asked where it would be. And she said, "Oh, I gave it to one of your other brothers." And he made a 30-mile trip or something to this brother to find it. The coat had been given to him after the father had died, and he'd just thrown it up in the attic. And they went to have a look, and it had been covered in a bee's nest. Bees had sort of set up home in it, so they got that off. Looked inside, and sure enough, something had been sewn into the lining, but it wasn't a second will. It was a note saying, "Go to my daddy's old Bible and look in Genesis." So again, their grandfather's Bible. So they went to the grandfather's Bible when they found where that was. And sure enough, there was a second will in there from their father, indeed signed and distributing the entire wealth to all five sons. This has been looked at again in recent times by Robert Sharman, I think, in, again, the Journal of the SPR, looking at the handwriting of the signature of the first will and the second will by handwriting experts, because that's all there really is to go on. Besides the accounts, really, and, you know, what is the ultimate motive here? Because no one's taking all the money for themselves, but that's what happened in the first case. But then again, it seems fairer to have it distributed if, you know, someone is making this up. And one of the interesting things about this, from a handwriting expert's opinion, is that the second signature looks like the person has actually got younger. Our handwriting changes as we get older, but they said the way in which the letters are formed suggests not someone that's got older, they've got younger. And so they weren't, the handwriting experts weren't overly convinced that it was necessarily the same person. But still, for many, many years, it has actually been put to one side as one of the most remarkable, still unexplained cases, because now it's so old, everyone was interviewed as far as possible, and it is what it is. Make of it what you will. But David and I looked at other cases as well, where people had the deceased come to them and say, look under this floorboard, and there's a tin box I've left under there, and inside is rolled up $500 in bills. And they, sure enough, they woke up and they went to find this floorboard, opened it up, and there was $500. So, you know, some really interesting accounts like that. And we would love to collect more and just do a book that's purely on dream interaction with the dead. But David is even more busy than I am. And so, you know, I end up having, I've got a book, my notebook, one notebook that is just full of book ideas. Should I ever get round to any of them? But every time I think, oh, that's a good idea for a book, or that's a good title for a book, I pop it in there, I write the date of when I've actually made some notes on it, and then I put it down again. So this book is becoming a book in itself, a book idea.
It will happen. You're so young yet, you've got loads of time, you know, to do it. It's all for a reason, I think. But I love these stories where it's just like an enduring mystery, because, you know, there could be a rational, logical explanation, but also there could be a paranormal one. And, you know, that could be that what if is what I find so engrossing, which brings me now, you know, the what ifs. I mean, you have been nominated for the Occam's Razor Award, mm-hmm. which is incredible. Congratulations. I was interviewed by Michael Marshall, I think, the skeptic who
won that year. He beat me.
So that's the, there's no beat. It doesn't matter. When you're nominated is enough, isn't it?
It's nice to be acknowledged. It's lovely.
Just a matter of opinion then. But, you know, you've been nominated for the Skeptic Award, but you also have written a book, Telephone Calls from the Dead. And when I speak to you, you are so respectful and sympathetic to people like Louise who've had these paranormal experiences. So what are you, Cal? Are you a skeptic? Are you inclined to believe? Or are you just above either there? Are you totally objective? Is that how you see yourself? I just want to know, what would you describe yourself as now?
I think if I was in any science, I'd adopt the same sceptical attitude. Every scientist has to be a sceptic. And so it also makes me think of two words that you've just used, rational and paranormal. Any of these experiences, I don't think any claim that someone is making is irrational. That they've made the claim, and often these are very kind of well-grounded people and well-meaning people that come forward honestly wanting to share their experiences. So the question then is, does the claim that they are making, does it fit somewhere within conventional scientific paradigms, conventional scientific ideas and what we understand about our psychology and the world around us? Or is something else going on? If something else is going on, that's where we get the term paranormal. But I think even that's misleading, because it's very common for people to have these experiences, so we call them normal. Even claims of telepathy can be, from surveys, 70 to 80% of the population will report them. So what we prefer to use are terms like anomalous. We're aware of it, but it's an anomaly in our logic, in the jigsaw. We've not quite got those pieces. But if we kind of have a bit of a hunt around, we'll find them. And it will tell us about, well, how do we get from A to C? Where's the B? And how does it work? And for psychologists and parapsychology, it's understanding now, really, what is the brain process behind it? What's going on in the brain when people have these experiences, or when, indeed, a psychic makes a claim that they can manipulate objects with their mind, or they claim they're hearing voices of the dead? That's where we can turn to neuroscience and cognitive psychology as well to try and understand it. So I am a skeptic. I'm someone that questions everything and looks for alternative. Even when we're doing lab studies, what are all the possible ways that someone could go about doing something that would appear special when actually it's not? And we put all these blockades in place to make sure that whatever we're left with has to be close enough to, you know, what the claim is in the first place, you know, be it remote viewing or dream telepathy, you know. Often we'll even make targets for participants that aren't selected till after they've done. So no one knows what the outcome's going to be, because it's actually a future event. It's not even set in stone yet. And yet some of their impressions, things that they come out with, seem to be pretty much bang on to the targets, when an independent judge not involved in the study looks at everything they've said and drawn and weighs it up against all the film clips, let's say, four film clips, and one of them is the target and the others are the decoy. You know, which one best fits? Which of these four best fits what they said? And overall, those outcomes seem to be really impressive, saying that, you know, they seem to pretty much hit the nail on the head here, or there's some really good relationships here. And so skeptic, I'm always questioning. And if I was an oncologist, if I was a chemist or anything like that, you know, different sciences have simpler mechanisms to deal with. Psychology is a very tricky one, but I'd still be questioning everything.
I love that, because skeptics have got a kind of a militant sort of feel about it in recent years. But actually, you're in the truest sense of the word skeptic, in which I actually encourage my listeners and readers, and in my latest title, Truth About Angels, I encourage everyone to be like a skeptic. I think being a skeptic is actually the spiritual way to live, because you're constantly open and asking questions and curious. And that's how I see it. So I actually think that being skeptical is being spiritual, in my humble opinion. But have you had any paranormal experiences yourself, or unusual experience? I mean, these experiences as well, we talk about them as if they're unusual, but they're not. They've been happening since the beginning of time. They're a universal kind of human experience that, you know, has been reported over and over again. And in any other line of work, it would be data, wouldn't it? In any other, you know, these experiences happen. Have you had any dreams, signs, visions, hunches that have made you question?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, that, isn't it, when it comes to some of the again, I mean, when you talk about militant skeptics, it depends on who you're talking to and what actually, you know, what is your day-to-day job, what in what sense are you a skeptic? And it's weird that you get some people that are skeptics that, you know, they've just got a day job in a factory or something, but they're part of a society that's on skepticism, and suddenly they are granted permission in some ways, or by their own peers, to speak about any science with authority. You know, I find that strange when I encounter a skeptic who's commenting on the quality of parapsychology and they're not a parapsychologist, and they're not involved with the literature. And like, well, what say do you actually have? Because I'm the skeptic, and I'm the one that's day-to-day paid to do this, and I know the literature. So, you know, how on earth would you know better? I wouldn't go to the GP saying, I think I've, you know, got something, I had a cut look on my finger, and I think it's got a bit infected. And then they give me an opinion, say, well, that's it, I'm leaving. I don't agree with you. Nonsense. You know, you wouldn't go to your GP to have an argument. You'd go for some advice from someone that seemingly knows more than you do. I find it very strange.
It's right. Beware the person who knows a little.
Yeah. But any other profession, you know, you just wouldn't get this kind of questioning. We do get a lot of kind of comments of day-to-day anomalous phenomena where people have the rebuttal of, oh, but it's just an anecdote. Well, let's use that in court then. Here we go. We've got eyewitness testimony from 10 people that this man committed a murder. Oh, but it's just anecdotes.
Yeah, exactly.
What a strange response to actually have. You know, these are eyewitness testimony. Yeah, but it's just one person's experience against the next. It doesn't necessarily validate the experience, really. Of course it does. If you've got so many people, it lends some good weight, the more and more people coming forward saying they've had a similar experience. And that's how it works. But it seems that people pick and choose when it actually can be used and can't be. And and that's the way that it seems to work with some sciences. But yeah, I've had a few. I think one that I discussed quite a lot recently when we were doing a parapsychology roundtable, again for BBC Radio Northampton, was on precognition. And particularly also when people might have dreams of the future. And one that always stood out to me was many years ago, I was going on a trip to London with my mother and one of her friends and her son. And I was probably about 12 or something like that at the time. And I do remember 2 weeks beforehand having a distinct dream about being in a room that was semi-lit, the lights were down, and I was in a big sort of zigzagging queue, you know, where they put the sort of a rope up and they make it a zigzag so they can fit more people in an orderly queue and wait, and you just got to follow the ropes going around like at a theme park or something. But this was inside a building. And I stood next to my mother, and at the time she was taller than me, so I remember that perspective of slightly looking up to talk to her in this room, stood in the queue. And I could see to the front of the queue, there were a load of black London taxi cabs cut in half, like Herbie, and it was just the back half. Loads of them in a line, just following each other, one after the other. And people were getting into them and then going off in them. And I thought, well, that's odd. I awoke and it stuck with me for a while because I thought it was so strange. What's that all about? So 2 weeks later, we go to London, go to the planetarium, lead you through into Madame Tussauds, went through there. And at the end, there was an option to do an extra bit of the tour. And the extra bit of the tour was actually a ride. Suddenly, I was in the queue and I was in the right place at the queue at the right time to be looking up to my mum, speaking to her in these sort of semi-lit conditions, looked ahead, and there is the ride that you go on. You sit in the back of these black London taxi cabs that are cut in half. And I thought, wow, you know, didn't benefit me in any way. It didn't help my survival. It's not like the building was going to collapse and I dreamt of that beforehand. But very specific information that I distinctly dreamt of beforehand. I think I must have spoke to my mum about it and said, this is it. Or a friend or something like that, but there was no advertising for anything like that. And I was in there, I was actually in the queue from that perspective. That's the only bit of my dream I remember, not walking into the room, not spending the whole time in the queue, but being at that specific point. It's kind of like in some ways when people have a deja vu experience, but that there are distinctions between that and having a dream of something before it happens. So I can certainly relate to some of those, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant, because it gave you a kind of a glimpse of your supernormal potential, and maybe your hunger to understand why is fueled, you know, what you're doing now. And that's, I love the way you said that the people you interview and research who've had these experiences, they come from all walks of life. And what I agree with you, they're often so open and they're so wanting to know more and to understand these experiences. It's more about understanding them, and maybe through understanding them, they understand themselves better, which is always a good thing. And Cal, I could talk to you for ages. You're such an interesting person, and I'm so grateful you spent the time, especially, and I feel terrible I took it away from Raven.
Oh, don't worry. I mean, she gets me all the time. I'm around all the time. So.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Just two quick questions to snatch from you before you go.
Yep.
again, have you got a sort of, I mean, your podcast, of course, is a great recommendation because I love people to listen to this podcast and have to go away and have things to research, a whole universe, a new universe to discover. So we've got Telephone Calls from the Dead, if they haven't read it, your previous podcast in season one with me, and your BBC Science Detectives podcast. Mm-hmm. Is there any recent film, movie, documentary, anything that you've seen or heard or read that you would recommend?
There's the Netflix series Surviving Death, which features Professor Chris Rowe throughout as, I suppose, the voice of skepticism. He's one of my, I suppose, my mentor and close colleague. Mentions my PhD in that as well at one point about
episode?
Oh, I don't know. It's probably towards the end. He's actually at the university at that point where he mentions that. And I think there are the potential, because it did so well, it was at number one in documentaries, Surviving Death. So there's potential for them following it up.
I hope you're in that, because you're brilliant in front of the camera, because you've done quite a lot of TV work, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I did last December. I was in the winter special of Paranormal Captured, which is on Sky on Pick TV. And next week, without giving too much away, there could be some follow-ups happening, so I'll just leave it there. So,
well, let me know and I can share.
Yes,
I can share on my socials at least.
So there's that, and besides BBC Sounds and looking up science detectives, there's also the parapsychology roundtable debate, I think it's called, and that's also through BBC Radio Northampton. But it's a group of us parapsychologists from Northampton discussing things like ESP and precognition and many other things. So that's also hosted by Helen Blaby. So if you look up those on BBC Sounds, you'll be able to actually hear some kind of really in-depth discussion about all of these specific topics for an hour. So we really try and get to the nitty-gritty of them. And other things, if you're just wanting to see what I'm doing day to day or any books that I'm reading at the moment, I tend to tweet about those. You can go to my website at www.callumecooper.com or at Twitter. So at Callum E. Cooper, and you'll find me.
It's important that E, because there's another Callum Cooper, isn't there?
I go by Cal Cooper or Callum E. Cooper. My author name has always been Callum E. Cooper, so I stick with that for my authorship. But casually, I'm always known as Cal.
What's the E for?
Oh, that'd be giving it away. I'm going to leave that as a mystery.
Oh, like Inspector Morse. We never knew his name. And don't ask me why, this final question, because my listeners of White Shores will know why, but I ask every guest at the end of season four, if they could be a musical instrument, what would it be and why?
Tricky. Maybe a harpsichord. I like
haven't
that.
Haven't had that yet. That's brilliant. Why? Is Bridgerton comes to mind there?
There's that Jane Austen. I like that time period of the harpsichord. There's a lot of kind of gothicness and early.
You take a turn around the room.
Yeah, turn around the room. There's a lot of early kind of spiritualist ideas going on there. Very nice, beautiful gothic clothing.
Absolutely.
And there's a romantic, cool and creepiness element to a harpsichord. And some of them, some rarer ones, they had drums inside them, so they had multiple pedals, so you had these kind of drums and cymbals and they sounded so cool. So without thinking too much, I'll go with that. I remember last time you interviewed me, I think I think that's the one that we struggled with. And it didn't come out. You asked me which person I'd be from Lord of the Rings, so that was Boromir.
No, that's in season one.
Oh, that was season one.
That. Yes.
Oh, there we go.
Yes. No, I did. There's always a weird question at the end. This time is music, because I love music and everything. So it's very interesting, because it kind of reveals a lot about a person that. So when I think of you now, I think of a harpsichord.
I think I've got... What have I got here?
What? You haven't got a harpsichord.
No, I haven't got a harpsichord. Okay. I had something. Raven had been going through some instruments.
Be interesting if she's going to follow your line of work and be as interested in the weird and wonderful as you are.
Oh, no, I'd tell her to go somewhere that earns money. So don't get into my line
Both
of
my
work.
My children are like that as well. You know, I'm spiritual. I sort of float around and they think, yeah, Mum, but where's the...
I'm fortunate I ended up in a dead man's boots position. It's a lot of reading, dedication and being in the right place at the right time.
Yes, but it's a vocation.
Oh,
and
yes.
I think loving your work, which I do and I know you do, is priceless. It's like children, they are priceless too. You know, there's some things in life that are priceless, and I wouldn't trade it in for anything.
No.
I'm sure you wouldn't either.
No, I wouldn't. I adore what I'm doing, because it's kind of exploring the mysteries of life. And I like something that keeps you questioning every day, but also something that it's a good, you know, it's a good dinner table discussion. When we do the round table discussion for parapsychology, we joke, you know, how long could we keep going on for without someone telling us to stop? I think we could go on for hours sometimes talking about this. I was wondering what instruments were in the living room. I found a harmonica. There we go.
No, you can't have two. You've got your harpsichord. That's greedy.
Let's have a bit of Last of the Summer Wine.
I don't know what to say, and that's quite something for me. Okay, you've done it. You're going speechless. Callum E. Cooper, well, Professor Callum E. Cooper, thank you so much for your time today. And I know we're going to chat again.
No problem. I think that sound odd in places, isn't it? With the raven coming in and out. But enjoy, everyone. I hope you've been.
That might be the title of your episode, Odd in Places.
Oh, it's a bit odd in places.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's a good book title, actually.
Yeah.
Odd
in Places. That could be, that'll eventually be my autobiography, I guess. It was a bit odd in places.
Thank you from my heart for being here and walking beside me in spirit on White Shores. Sensitive, kind and compassionate souls like you who see beyond the material are needed more than ever today to help the world heal. Thank you to Clan Ree for the blissful episode music, and do check out the show notes for all details about this episode and my contact details. I'm going to say goodbye for now with a musical or literary offering, a piece of heaven for you to take away and store in your heart as you return refreshed to your one precious life. Until we meet again on these white shores, keep being amazing spiritual you, sending my eternal love and gratitude.